Good afternoon. This is an exciting day. We're going to another edition of the Mycotoxin and Chronic Illness Summit. And today I have a real pleasure, a chance to chat with Dr. Richie Shoemaker. Dr. Shoemaker has sort of been one of the leading lights in my life in treating chronic illness. I had a patient come into me in 2001, I believe, clutching a book and and with a present of a visual contrast sensitivity chart. And I've been following and admiring and enjoying Dr. Shoemaker's ideas ever since. And I've always been amazed at how much he has to teach us. Today, we're going to start off with a title that I actually like. It's a radically different view of mycotoxin illness. And so, Dr. Shoemaker.
Well, Dr. Gordon, you're looking younger these days.
COVID. No haircuts. And I kept it up.
So you asked me to talk, and I think we'll have a conversation, not a talk and not a lecture. But there are some advances that have happened in the world of molecular biology that really do impact people with chronic fatigue as part of their basic source of illness. Now that we know that multi-system, multi-symptom illnesses share not only proteomic markers, and we have in SIRS, we have over 20 biomarkers, some proteomic, some not. If we look at chronic fatigue syndrome, for example, another example of a chronic fatiguing illness, we don't have any biomarkers at all. Fibromyalgia, there's no biomarker. So how can this be that one discipline of chronic fatigue medicine has got 20 biomarkers shown in peer-reviewed literature and here a much wider literature in fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome? The experts haven't agreed on any.
Yes, and they've wasted a lot of money looking.
Well, we couldn't afford to waste any money. We didn't have much to waste. The latest invention, and credit goes to Dr. James Ryan, Jimmy as he likes to be called, noticed early on when we were doing next generation sequencing and sequencing 50,000 genes, that was the whole human genome, for a cost of about $2,000 a pop. We didn't sell too many tests. But the finding was that there was a marked consistency in ill patients of suppression of production of ribosomal messenger RNA. And the implication is that you don't have mRNA for ribosomes, you don't make proteins needed for ribosomes, you don't make proteins needed for other spots. And so, well, what would happen if a host had a factor that shut down ribosomal RNA production? Well, the cell wouldn't do very well, but it probably wouldn't die. Along with that ribosomal problem, and large and small ribosomes both share the same findings, Dr. Ryan noticed that ribosomes in mitochondria, mitoribosomes, also were suppressed. Well, that's interesting. And then if we look at mitochondria, and as you know, there's only 37 mitochondrial genes left in mitochondria themselves, the rest have migrated to the nucleus. We talk about nuclear encoded mitochondrial genes. Well, that means that in order for a mitochondrial gene to have any play inside the cell, it's got to have mRNA made. Got to copy the DNA. And if there happens to be microRNA or long non-coding RNA or ribonuclear proteins around, that output can be suppressed, and it is very frequently. So if we say there's a mitochondrial component to an illness, are we really just saying there's a mitochondrial gene suppression? Well, if we look at examples of ATP synthase, which is suppressed as a bunch of genes, we know that ATP production, even if pyruvate gets into the mitochondria, which we'll get to that in a sec, that ATP synthase reduction will follow. So what if we have suppression of the electron transport chain, cyclooxygenases, all that? What if those proteins are suppressed and the mRNA is suppressed? What will happen then? You'll have reduced mitochondrial function, but does that mean there's a problem with the ribosome? Functionally, no. It's like the plant you've left on your desk for 2 weeks. If you don't water it, it probably won't do very well. You give it some water, it's amazing how new growth will appear. But specifically, let's get to translocases, because most people don't realize that the outer mitochondrial membrane is not just a passive barrier to flow of one, two, or two things. There are pores, or in some cases, voltage-dependent anion channels, about 20 nanometers in size, that must be open for the mitochondria to be fed the water on the plant we're talking about on your desk. That's how solutes, ions, ADP, and pyruvate get across the outer mitochondrial membrane. And then mitochondrial proteins need the participation of translocases, trans, variable, location, 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 real estate, but it also has to do with mitochondria. So if you don't translocate proteins made from mRNA by ribosomes, because it's not being made or they can't get through, will the mitochondrial function be normal? No. So this whole idea of Dr. Ryan finding what an elegant mechanism in, we've extended the last 4 years to show we find this in heart failure, both dilated and non-dilated, congestive and ischemic, no different. And we see in chronic renal failure, we see in collagen vascular diseases, we see it in chemotherapy, we see it in radiation therapy to a lesser extent. But all of these findings are saying, is there a basic molecular mechanism to turn down energy production, because that also turns down energy demand for the production to occur? Or do we also turn down the demand for energy production by turning down the mechanisms that are needed to produce that energy? So if the cell is being attacked, and for sake of today's arguments, we're going to talk about ribotoxins, and we're going to talk about ribosomal inhibitory proteins, but we need to have a quick...
I just want to make sure that everybody understands what the ribosome is and does, because, it's where RNA is read and made into a protein, okay? And that's why it's so important, because until the RNA is read, it's just a piece of protein, nucleic acid floating around, okay?
And mRNA is 2,000 nucleotides long, and microRNA is 20 nucleotides long. We need to account for both of these different sized particles in our processes of my favorite thing. Disease is, are you ready?
Okay.
Lack of regulation of gene transcription. Four layers.
I'm not sure about all four layers, but I'll agree 100%. Lack of regulation is the difference between health and disease. Absolutely. You'll teach us about the four layers.
If we continue on for two more hours, we may have time to double back and talk about that. But proteins live in the nucleus, but they're not a nucleus. They don't have a membrane bound on them. And there's multiple gene functions for these ribonuclear proteins that we don't know. There's over 300 proteins associated with nucleic acids sitting in Cahill bodies and speckles and paraspeckles. You don't hear that on 60 Minutes on the news. But at the same time, what are these regulatory elements doing? And then if we've got long non-coding RNAs, we're finding out more and more about what they do to regulate gene production. But then microRNA.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, just one more little definition. I'm going to keep bugging you on these because I don't want people to follow. Long non-coding RNAs and microRNAs seem, and correct me if I'm correct, have more to do with regulating. They are regulators rather than things that we're busy transcribing and making into proteins.
And same thing with ribonuclear proteins as well. They all regulatory as best that I can tell. There may be non-regulatory functions, but at the same time, if we look at the control of RNA, we look at transcription, for example, and there are some elements that are involved with this. Epigenetics talks about methylation, but more importantly is acetylation, and more important is deacetylation, and more important is demethylation.
Right.
The regulatory aspects of gene transcription are remote. But imagine if you've been working hard in the fields all day, making mRNA, and you release it in the nucleus, knowing that you've given free passage to this dove of peace of all this 2,000 nucleotides. It's going to traverse the nuclear membrane and get into the cytoplasm and find a ribosome. Isn't that exciting, birth-defining event? Until a missile comes along, a microRNA, and destroys that microRNA mRNA complex. What happened to your mRNA? It was made normally. Regulation of DNA was normally functioning. MicroRNA just shot it down. Oh no, all that wasted nucleotide. Is the nucleotide actually wasted, or does it get recycled?
Hopefully recycled.
We can talk about autophagy another time. Yes. Maybe we'll talk about apoptosis and viral infection and COVID, because they're all tied together. But there are no cell materials truly that are wasted. But anyway, I digress. By looking at regular or lack of same, we're also looking at the model for a ribotoxin system to disrupt protein synthesis. Now let's take out your microscope, and I want you to look at a structure between the large and small subunit of ribosomes, both large and small ribosomes. These subunits surround a little structure called the sarcin-ricin loop. Now you've heard of ricin, right?
You know, right, very effective, yeah, killing people, yes. It's sarcin and ricin.
Plant toxin made by the castor bean. Right. But how come it's got its name with this sarcin-ricin loop? Ricin exerts its negative effect on life by disrupting in this loop of nucleotides called the loop, sarcin-ricin loop. In the 15th position, there's an adenosine moiety. You remember GCAT in your DNA? Well, this is the A, and it's part of a loop. And with adenosine, there can be initial attachment of a three codon piece of mRNA called attachment. There can be a sequential attachment of another three nucleotide piece called elongation. And then there can be a stop signal that comes out, another three codon nucleotide called termination. That's how protein synthesis is supposed to work. mRNA signal says, put together 25 amino acids, 30 amino acids, whatever the code says, and you make the protein. Only with ricin and sarcin, sarcomere inhibitors, the names aren't too fancy, they knock off the ability for that mRNA to attach, and certainly knock off the ability to elongate, and certainly knock off the ability to terminate. Oh my goodness, how do you get any protein made? The answer is, if you're poisoned by ricin, very often you'll die. But what if you are poisoned by exposure to a Chorione bacteria, one of the ones we know about with diphtheria, that makes toxins? But it makes ribotoxins like crazy. It's an actinomycete. And lo and behold, the reason we don't talk much about mycotoxins anymore is while they make ribotoxins, they're crummy. They're activated very easily by glutamine. And they don't really do very much. About 7% of people with SIRS have mycotoxin injury. Compare that to actinomycetes, the biggest genus by far in all of microbiology. Yes. Mycetes is, of course, way up there in that collection of genii. But specifically, they're 42% of SIRS patients. And then lowly endotoxin, the thing we wanted to ignore, except if you're septic, is 28% of chronic illness. We know endotoxin by looking at NeuroQuant, the distinctive pattern of loss of gray matter nuclei and dilated superior lateral ventricle and loss of cortical gray tells me almost up to a percentage point that endotoxin was involved and initiated for this illness. If you have problems with mycotoxins, you'll have a lot of inflammatory problems. If you have problems with endotoxins, it's brain injury. If you have actinomycetes, it's metabolic problems, because actinomycetes knock out complex 1 with pyrcidin A and complex 3 with oligomycin of the electron transport protein chain. So if you want,
you know, just 1 minute, I mean, you just, you have said a lot of very important things, but especially, so let me just go back for a minute. So when you're seeing endotoxins, that's when you would be thinking more about those with the people, the more neurologic presentations. Has that lined up? clinically?
No, they have a 37 symptom program like all of these patients do. So right. They have 23 symptoms, but you can't distinguish the metabolic source of injury from the endotoxin mechanism of injury based on symptoms. Symptoms remain. Some people have argued with me at the HAHS meetings for Lyme disease. I said symptoms are probably the worst mechanism to use for delineation of SIRS that there is. And someone else said, well, my Lyme patients, they're the very best. And I said, your group of symptoms are no different than my group of symptoms, and I know they aren't good.
Okay. Well, that's the thing. I mean, because we've been flying on the symptom train for a long time. You know, because I said in the past, I always found the lab tests to be non-specific for causation. And, you know, you're right. And everybody's, I always laughed, like one man's Bartonella symptoms is another man's Babesia symptoms. So we can't be too attached to that.
Come on, mold patients got more just exactly the same as Babesia.
Absolutely. I mean, that, but there's flavors. I mean, at least we think there are flavors. And
sorry, you stir up the ice cream, you got chocolate and strawberry, they all turn out to brown, whatever you're going to do.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, but just going back, what you're saying is that even though that you find that the endotoxin predominant person will have more likely a neuroquant, a specific pattern on neuroquant, you're really not directly relating that to symptomatology.
Symptomatology remains the study of symptoms, and we're not really talking about that. My understanding that symptoms need to be corrected for people to regain perception of health. But I also maintain that correction of objective biomarkers, molecular mechanisms, is necessary to eliminate disease.
I love it. Keep going. Okay.
So perception of disease, mechanism of disease, which do we want? We've chased the chronic fatigue syndrome world, chased after symptom rosters for years.
Oh yeah. Ridiculous. Absolutely. You're right.
There's no point in arguing about it. You know, yeah. let's get something else. So the mechanisms then get to be one that we can say, does one protocol fit all? And if you have molecular hypometabolism, the beauty of the one protocol that I've used since 1997 is that it corrects molecular hypometabolism. It corrects proliferative physiology. And if you don't know that you have that, you're going to say, I feel pretty good. My symptom is saying proliferative physiology is not hurting me. That's right. When a cell's dividing, making plenty of building blocks, there's no shortage of building blocks, and things feel pretty good. Cells aren't having apoptosis. They're not dying all the time. But meanwhile, the brain's being rotted. Meanwhile, pulmonary hypertension is being accomplished because of those exact same mechanisms. And Otto Warburg, while he left out glutamine in his assessment, he didn't know where the ammonia was coming from in the cell culture.
Right.
It has to do with glutaminergic pathways that we know about, and biosynthetic pathways themselves. But the key issue is that you get a false sense of security when you take an antifungal. You say, I feel pretty good. If you're taking itraconazole, that blocks the VDAC. Nothing gets through. So you say, well, I'm feeling pretty good. Meanwhile, your brain is dying. Meanwhile, your pulmonary artery pressure is getting bad. And by the time you leave the doctor to go to a new one, he says, don't use antifungals. That's when we find pulmonary hypertension to be bad. That's when we find that the neuroquant is showing the complications from endotoxins or from actinos, which also block VDAC.
Well, you know, this is perception, mechanism. I'm with you. We like to treat the mechanism when we can. It's, as I said, the thing about medicine is that we see each other's failures and we see where things don't, but you are learning, and that's what's so exciting about the genie is I think that you're getting more and more of these pieces, and I'm just very excited that you're putting this puzzle together for us. So
have you ever worked up somebody for a TIA?
Yeah.
Sure. And what do we say? Transient ischemic attack.
Right.
It was transient. Well, it didn't last very long. Ischemic means lack of blood flow. But where was the attack? It doesn't show on CAT scan. It doesn't show on MRI. Right. 3 Tesla coil, but it does show on a 9 Tesla coil. And TIAs are now capillary hypoperfusion that go on to microclots and microbleeds. Right. And in the areas of capillary beds, there will be the presence of amyloid beta protein hooking on to coagulation compounds, creating the ability to have a clot in a microvascular circulation, and with no blood flow going beyond the clot, guess what? You've got distal hypoxia, which serves as a stimulus for what? Phosphatol. So are we looking at a mechanism, the vascular hypothesis of neuronal injury? I wish I could say it was my idea. Sidney Strickland from the University of Rockefeller in New York is one who's written more than I've written about that. It's absolutely fantastic. But what was the vascular basis of the clot initiation? Is it a clotting factor that we can measure? Heaven forbid there would be a laboratory that would do all the clotting factors we can get, compared if we look at the genes for clotting abnormalities. Oh my goodness. In the integrin deficiency, BP6, GP6, GP9, where did all these things come from? Where's factor 5? Where's factor 12? Well, there too. They're probably 5 to 10% of what we want to.
Life happens. You know, but I mean, that has always been the frustration, is that the clotting systems that we can look at through regular blood tests are clearly only a tiny component, because we see lots of people, everything is normal, and they still have clotting events or microthrombi all the time. So with Genie, you can see the growth, the genes that are upregulated and turned on or suppressed that will create these clotting abnormalities?
Absolutely, you can. One of the exciting things was to correlate neuroquant abnormalities with the vascular hypothesis of neuronal injury. But what we can see is that the mean number of gray matter nuclear atrophy together with white matter and gray matter together, two areas, is 6.15 out of 8 if you've got 4 or more coag genes upregulated. Just coagulation genes up in association with brain injury. The best part is when you fix the gene, we can heal the brain injury.
Okay. Now that's exciting. Okay.
Now that was in 2017. It's on the Survive Mode website. Take a look at it.
Okay.
We use VIP, but we now know that VIP corrects the coagulation abnormalities. So what were we doing when we fixed gray matter nuclear atrophy? Likely we're fixing the vascular source of that at all.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And if you take away the what I call CDR2, what you call proliferative metabolism. Yeah, you can let things actually heal instead of scar.
Already, Eric, this is vitally important.
What? I'm not rushing.
No, I did. But you spoke Russian. I know. Heaven forbid. But proliferative physiology is a word that was part of your vocabulary, and I want it to be part of everybody's vocabulary. If we are having proliferative physiology, we either are pumping glucose into the biosynthetic pathway to make new cells, or we're in a situation where we won't have pyruvate transported across the outer mitochondrial membrane to get into the mitochondria for energy production. So that means lactic acid. If you've got lactic acid locally, there will be metabolic acidosis. Is that metabolic acidosis going to be stimulating phosphatol? I haven't heard anybody explain that, but hypoxia and lack of energy goes together with lactic acidosis. So I think it will be a factor. But having said all that, as we go further down what a Genie report will show, we looked at cytokines, and that was very exciting, because so many people will get a Luminex panel and get 15 cytokines, not knowing that on average, 30% of those are gonna be wrong.
Yeah, those are my most disappointing tests. I do them rarely, and then every time I do, I'm usually sorry.
Even more sorry are the people that use ELISA testing for cytokine abnormalities. There are so many similar structures or epitopes, so that those are not really very useful. So the question is, how really are we going to assess protein modification, of which there's 300 different kinds, that will affect proteins after the mRNA has done its thing and after the sarsen ribose loop has done its thing? You've made the protein and now it gets changed. That's where the diversity of the human organism comes in, is protein diversity by modification. So it gets all very complicated, and how can you measure a protein accurately if it's been modified?
Yeah, with difficulty.
So there we go, back to gene analysis. And now, in order to do gene analysis, guess what you need, Eric?
Waiting.
A control group.
Ah.
And guess what's missing most of the time, and people yes. have exciting events and exciting findings, exciting discoveries, is the null hypothesis says everything you said is wrong. And that's unfortunate that science has that null hypothesis, but it's so often the case that, you know, I did this 50 times and it happened, you know, it's like flipping a coin, 49 times it came up, you know, tails. Well, one time it came up heads. So it's 49-1. That's significant, isn't it? Well, maybe it is, but the statistics start getting to the point that if you can't prove it statistically, it probably is not going to satisfy the null hypothesis. And gene transcription needs a huge control group. And I can remember Jimmy Ryan still to this day saying, I need more controls. I need more controls and I need more controls. So every advance that we make in science, usually there's a step backwards.
And right, you get the idea, you try it, and you find out where it didn't quite hold.
And then you can either adapt your protocol or adapt your module, or ignore the fact that there was a failure. And the data don't lie. And that's one of the things that really matters. And so if we start looking at gene data, we can get those very nicely in any number of different places. We'll give you a Z-score or a comparison at 0.05 statistical significance of the difference of a gene from controls. And that becomes vitally important when we start looking at some breakthroughs, I don't know if we've talked to you about, in multiple chemical sensitivity.
Ah,
and I used
another great quandary. Yes, I'd love to hear.
Yes, patients coming in because I knew they were suffering and I felt their pain, but I couldn't do much of anything that worked. What I didn't have was a case definition. What is MCS to you might be MCS to me, maybe, but maybe not. You know, it was a Supreme Court justice who said, I know pornography when I see it. Well, I used to say, I know MCS when I see it. And sometimes I saw it and sometimes I didn't. It's a very humbling disease. But specifically, if we look at an anti-inflammatory group of zinc finger proteins called Icarus, there's three of these genes. We add up their Z-scores compared to controls. And if we give a positive number, then the comparison to VIP receptor one, yes, that's the VIP receptor itself. Who cares what VIP levels are? I want to know what the receptor shows. But if the receptor is negative and Icarus is positive, that mismatch correlates 85% with people with environmental sensitivity. And environmental sensitivity can be multiple chemical sensitivity, food sensitivity, or drug sensitivity. Fascinating, a non-specific finding. And like you said, it doesn't say what chemicals a person reacts to, just says they do. And pay attention. Conversely, we had a case today, a great case. Person's been doing beautifully. Hypometabolism's been fixed. Peg DiTullio is doing a gorgeous job. She's in New Hampshire. Everything's looking fine. The guy still has some brain injury and he has some anxiety that's not fixed. Well, he didn't have the mismatch of positive Icarus and negative VIPR1. He had the reverse. Negative Icarus and positive VIPR1, which is associated with accentuated CNS injury. He had exposure to endotoxins. Guess what? He had superior lateral ventricle dilation, cortical gray atrophy, and 5 out of 6 gray matter nuclear atrophy. So he had gray matter problems up the wazoo, and he's going to need VIP for a year to fix the cortical gray and superior lateral ventricle. Well, we now know we can fix that. Back when you and I talked, where was that conference anyway, before COVID, we didn't
know. Right. We were in Texas.
In Houston, that's right.
Houston, right.
Anyway, I didn't know about the accentuated CNS injury back then, didn't know about MCS back then. So it's a matter, if you wait long enough, something will bound stumble over your door some way or other.
Yeah, okay, so this is, I mean, because yeah, MCS is just one of those things that, we're looking to turn down the reactivity, but it's different. And I mean, the reason it's hard to define it is because, as I say, for me, most of the people I see, the diseases, it's their individual response that's what's that the problem it lies. You know, it's not like, it's not the Lyme, it's not the mycotoxin or the water damage building toxin. It's how their body responds, because, you know, 10 other people have the same exposures and feel fine. So it's all about the individual, but the MCS are even a more refined group of that, because
one of the more humbling elements in medicine is that if you find that you can identify a objective parameter with MCS, you're partway there. You validate the illness. You validate the illness in skeptics' eyes, insurance companies' eyes, saying, I can show you the gene basis of why I react to air freshener or cigarette smoke or any of the diesel fumes. And the list goes on and on and on. But every one of those patients we saw and didn't help, we tried to, yes, we did. But they were telling us, I have a mechanism that's gone awry that is a result of my illness. I may react differently than my friend and my neighbor, but I've got a mechanism that is bound to be one you can find. And exactly that has happened. And as we go further, looking at metabolic abnormalities, beta tubulins, beta tubulins A4A, BB1, there's a whole series of them, are associated with the ability of cell to divide. Proliferative physiology looks at cell division. What if that microtubule is not able to attach to the centromere, that section of the chromosome that has a kinetochore protein? That's where the microtubule attaches. Microtubules should pull one chromosome to one side and the other chromosome to another side of the dividing cell. It divides down the middle and boom, you got two identical cells. But if the centromere is not functional and the kinetochore protein is not functional because the tubulins are blocking the voltage-dependent anion channel, will we have cell death of the reproductive trough ring? Yes. So this is a bad actor. So when I said proliferative physiology gives you a false sense of security, you're also creating an element of death of the offspring.
Wow. Okay. And do those guys die peacefully or do they fall apart? I mean, are they really going through apoptosis or are they going through other kinds of cell death?
Depends on what mechanisms are active for apoptosis. For many that have viruses, you'll see point activation of BCL2 in our post-COVID syndrome. Our paper was published yesterday, and I sent a copy of it to you.
Yes, I read it. Exciting.
Ask, here they are.
Yeah.
But the issue is that if we look at this viral evasion of apoptosis is a mechanism to kill the cell and kill the virus that's in it. Virus says, I don't want to be killed. So it sets off blockers of apoptosis. You block the classical pathway. The cell membrane never forms around the guts like it's supposed to, the cell contents, and the cell doesn't die. But what if you have defective apoptosis? A gene, RIPK1, turns on the right chromosome. RIPK1, RIP3, LR3. There's a whole bunch of them we don't test for. But this is a mechanism to kill the cell without going through apoptosis. So you release free DNA, you release ribosomes, you release mitochondria.
Very inflammatory. Yeah.
Boy, talk about a cytokine storm. Mm-hmm. Now, I used that term in 2001 talking about Lyme disease when people got cholestyramine, they felt horrible. And yet, believe it or not, cytokine storm is still in our lexicon thanks to the effect of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
It's not new. It was described 20 years ago.
Yes. Yep. You know, we saw it then. So going back, I said just one thing for the Icarus. What are they coding for?
Icarus are a group of anti-inflammatory genes. When you have Icarus turned on, inflammatory genes get turned off. The best example is APOE4 and all of its genes that it's acting on is blocked by Icarus. So if you don't want to have an APOE4, you'd rather have APOE2, you're not likely as much of a cardiovascular event. But if you have problems with Th17 Treg imbalance, you're going to have a cardiac event whether you've got APOE4 or not. We can tell you that with Genie as well.
Oh, okay. But that is, now, you know, it's what's so exciting is how many pieces are coming together from different, I mean, you know, you're sitting there, you know, like you say, like describing, you know, dementias, you know, and, you know, it just so many different types of, you know, chronic inflammatory, because, you know, basically in my worldview, chronic disease is chronic, is just dysregulated inflammation. And you're sitting there kind of telling me that you've got a way of looking at the control panel for a lot of that.
When you add metabolism, you're not wrong. Like I told you, you take science, we go as far as science will let us go. And when inflammation was all we could measure, that's what we thought the problem was. Right. Metabolism has shown out to be a problem with, you know, hypometabolism, especially on a molecular basis. That's also saying that is added to inflammation, and the metabolic abnormalities create inflammatory processes.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, again, it's how you cut the circle. In my stories, the inflammation is often what's causing the hypometabolic state.
Right.
But it doesn't really matter. I mean, because at the end of the day, it's getting the system back to self-regulation, and modulating this is going to get us to the next, to back to health.
I think there's an expression, the rounder we go, the faster we get. We're chasing inflammation and chasing metabolism with metabolism and inflammation respectively. The rounder you go, the faster you get. The answer is, if we stop the ribotoxin initiation of the protein abnormalities, good things will happen. You get off the boat and you start using four-letter words that are dear to my heart. I never used them much in the past. They're called cure. When you fix metabolism, you fix inflammation, and you show that the steady state's been achieved for 6 months, means they're out of re-exposure. Life's good. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is excellent. So as we're running through this, the fields of Genie. You know, as so, how are you? You know, right now you're doing how many? You're measuring about 100, and you said 180, 188 transcriptomic or ribos. You know, actually, yeah.
Jimmy showed that we had 2,000 nearabouts genes that were upregulated or downregulated in our SIRS patients compared to 50,000 all told.
Right.
And the question is, all right, what flavor of candy bar would you like, Johnny? You're in the candy store. You only get 188. So what Jimmy did was pick out the 188 with the highest signal to noise ratio. So the most bang for the buck. So the low signal ratio like interferon, we don't include because it's just not good enough to separate out. If we get a hit on interferon, is that signal or is it noise?
Right.
And if you ask me to define how Jimmy figured out signal and noise, I'll refer you to the methods that he wrote that are in our last paper, because I didn't write it and I can't tell you.
Okay. Yeah. You came up with the about 188, and how are you, you know, right now when you look at, like I said, the post-Lyme people, Lyme patients, chronic fatigue, the water damage building components, as you say, and the mycotoxin people, you know, how much crossover are you seeing, or how much are you able to really delineate the groups?
I used to talk in lecture about peeling the onion. I think you might have given a similar talk yourself. Do one thing at a time.
Yeah.
Get down to the kernel right on the inside. We have to do multiple things at a given time, because multiple changes of drug intervention of a given protocol will be occurring. It's not any onion at all. It's many onions all being peeled. Some are being peeled faster than others, but each has to be peeled to get to the final kernel of all of them. That's where the cure lives. The mistake that I made was thinking one intervention, one change. It was one intervention and multiple changes that I didn't know about happening with the one I did know about.
Yeah. Well, that's when you work with the body. You know, that's kind of what we depend on when we work at the body. You know, that's what healing is about. We do one thing and then the body goes off and does a lot of stuff. You know, we said it was easier to fix cars, you know. Actually, it's easier to fix people sometimes, because cars don't heal themselves, people do. So, you know, get with the idea that you don't have to be right all the time. If you start the process, sometimes the body will continue it. But getting back, I want to get back to the Genie test, because I'm really, I said, I was interested in it, but it sounds like you've taken it to a new level now and something I really want to understand. So are you able to delineate I know you feel you can delineate treatments, but can delineate the major drivers, if you will, or are you predominantly looking, like you say, at the mechanism and and again, very appropriately, I think, not worrying about what necessarily triggered it, but what's going on in the individual today?
Well, if you read the paper we published in March, we've been publishing a lot lately, yeah. You've seen for the first time depiction of precision specific causation. We're looking here at people exposed to actinomycetes. We have an environmental sample where in dust we find more than 16 or more species. We also find immune reactivity with MAP kinases, low level reactive, mycotoxins, very high level reactive. But we also then have the third component that if you've got exposure confirmed and you've got MAP kinases, nonspecific but stimulators, a whole series of downstream anabolic and catabolic events, both reacting, and you have TGF-beta-1 receptor activity, we have got specific causation. Now, Scott McMahon wanted the word precise come in there. He has medical legal reasons for wanting to include that. But specifically, for the first time, we can tease out actinos out of the vortex of amorphous items, that 32 different categories of things that make people sick known in water-damaged buildings. We can also...
Maybe.
Daughter's having a tweet storm.
Oh.
Also, you can look at endotoxins with specific causation for them. CD14 and TOL4 are specific for endotoxins. So in answer of, can we separate Lyme out? Yes, we use the work that came out of San Francisco, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jerome Bouquet and Charles Chu from UCSF and John Alcott from Hopkins. Maryland's got to get their name in there somewhere. But he did, looked at people with acute Lyme manifested by a bite and an EM rash and an illness. And so he had the EM rash in there. So if you didn't have an EM rash, you maybe weren't covered by a study. But he treated people for 3 weeks with doxy and then didn't give any more antibiotics. Of course, it's Hopkins. And then looked at them, finding 6 months later, what genes were still abnormal. Well, there's a whole slew of them, of course, because there are gene activations from Lyme that were not being treated. But we can sort out those genes. And that's one of the elements we have, undiagnosed Lyme disease or Lyme that's been treated within 6 months. So that's made a big, big progress. If we've got something we worry about Bartonella, we look at defensins because other bacteria, other viral infections are there. Bartonella lights up like a Christmas tree. So it's really nice if someone says I got Bartonella and they went to Galaxy and maybe they had a test and maybe they didn't. You know, Ed Eichwort had... We were both given a talk at the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene years and years ago, and the elevator got stuck between the first floor and the lecture hall. So we had 45 minutes to talk in the dark about Bartonella, and Ed talked most of the whole time. There's 28 different species of Bartonella that he'd identified that were pathogenic in dogs.
Right.
How many were pathogenic in people? And yeah. Could we have Bartonella and not know it? And I came along in 2003, we had a fellow, actually, it was 2003. For the first time, he published a silver methenamine stain of Bartonella in a lymph node, and that was exciting. So we took a lymph node out of a patient with Bartonella who had cat scratch fever, as we called it back then, or Roche Malaya, and I probably pronounced that wrong. But we sent it off to him, and he grew it out of our lymph node, the first in the world.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And you can get cat scratch fever from lots of things. We had a guy with a monkey scratch. Was in a cat, he was at a zoo, he got a cat scratch, and there it was, epitrochlear node positive for Bartonella. Unbelievable. Plumbers working underneath crawl spaces and all that is a problem.
No. Bartonella is a nasty. So the defensins definitely pop up high. The other thing that, we're looking at some T cell reactivity these days to get a better idea of, when the bug is actually active.
Tell me about
would be interesting correlations.
Tell me about your T cell assay, because if you've got CD3D deficiency, that is the CD marker for the interaction between an antigen presenting cell and a naive T lymphocyte. if you that gene is downregulated, you won't have that interaction. You won't have T cell reactivity at all.
Well, that could explain some of the maybe some of the negative tests in people who we think have Bartonella. But you know, it's that is always the problem with every test when we're looking downstream, like generally we do in medicine. You know, I mean, this has always been the issue. If the immune system isn't working the way we want, that's what we've always been able to look at is just immune, you know, like IgGs and now, and, you know, and also T cell reactivity. But yeah, if the communication isn't working, it's not going to show up.
If we go back to COVID for a minute, defective antigen presentation is of concern in vaccination. Yeah. I get the question every day nearabouts. Should I get vaccinated if my CD3D is downregulated? Well, chances are that you run a risk of having defective antigen presentation. And so your negative test, if it's an antibody-based test, the antibody is dependent on having normal antigen presentation all the way through. And there's no guarantee that's going to be the case. So that's why physiologic elements make more difference to me than antibody tests.
I'm with you there. But that's right. Your poor T cell. Yeah. T cells. I mean, this is, but one of the, well, every area is so dense. I mean, your immunology is what you know far better than I, that, you know, we just keep finding more different cell types and more different ways that the cells communicate with each other. You know, I mean, years ago, people thought that B cells and T cells, you know, they didn't realize how B cells have huge amount of regulatory effects on T cells. I mean, everything's in communication. The body is one big soup.
There's an editorial in Nature Reviews Immunology years ago. He was talking about the different phenotypes for natural killer cells. He said there's 28,000.
Okay.
You say you're wrong. There's not 28,000. There's 228,000.
Right. Right. I mean, we have to split and lump in order to talk about things. We just have to remember that's often not what's really happening, but it's what we need to do. And you've done so just as an overview. So with the Genie test now, how are you using it clinically?
I use it to look for, let's just start with post-COVID people. TGF-beta-1 signaling is gigantic. We've all known about pulmonary fibrosis and interstitial lung disease was dependent on endothelial to mesenchymal transformation, or EMT, run by SMAD, turned on by TGF-beta-1 receptors. Well, guess what? That's a huge player in post-COVID syndrome. For people that have COVID and have recovered, some people have symptoms that affect activities of daily life, other people don't. And if you're still sick 6 weeks later with impairment of activities of daily life, I can almost guarantee you that 64% of people like you will have endotoxin reactivity and 56% will have actinomycetes activity. This is incredible. The COVID patients are released to go as a deformed host, as an effective host, a defective antigen presentation host, into an environment that was safe before. But now, because these organisms live in homes hugely throughout the US, they are now exposed and now they're gonna pay the price. So is the gradual accumulation of new symptoms a result of pulse viral expansion of the transcriptome? Or is it new susceptibility, new priming events to old pathogens we could ignore and fight off before? I think that we cannot determine that until we treat with something like well-collar cholestyramine for 2-3 weeks before jumping in with VIP, which will fix TGF-beta-1 receptor. So now that we've got specific layers of treatment, we can conclude specific layers of injury.
Yeah. Well, this sounds similar to, you know, I think you said this, it's been a long time. I always liked it though, is that, you know, we did see that many people did not become quote unquote, you know, water damage building sensitive or mycotoxin sensitive until after they had, you know, an infection like Lyme and then later became, you know, much more sensitive to their environment. Is that something you think something similar is happening or exactly the same?
I use the term a cytokine priming event. There needed to be a cytokine dominant illness. For example, one person got bitten by tick bites repeatedly in Connecticut, never had a problem until he had yellow jackets by the handful sting him. He had 6 or 7 stings. And shortly thereafter, he started getting Lyme disease routinely. So something was changed with HLA. Something was changed with the molecular control mechanisms by that cytokine event. I don't know what it is in COVID. I wish I could say it's RIPK1. It's something not just RIPK1, but that's an intensely inflammatory element. So we use it for post-COVID syndrome. We use it for people who don't feel well. We use it for people that know they've been in a water-damaged building. We use it for people especially that think they have mycotoxins, they're still sick. They take antifungals and it doesn't fix the mechanism. But if you go after the physiology, antifungals have their own presentation right there. We can see it. Basically a shutdown BDAC and tubulins up the wazoo.
Okay. And are you changing your program? I mean, as far as the steps in your program based on the genie, or is it just making you feel that you better know what to, you know, what are you doing differently based with genie?
Haven't changed this order of events or the steps at all. I've been using a low dose VIP program for people with environmental sensitivities as a run up to using any medications. That's been one change because we can show correction of CD3D with that one. But specifically, when I jumped in with Genie, found that by skipping steps in my protocol, I actually was not helping anybody at all. And we still say remove from exposure, a month of binders at minimum, continue with binders, eradicate Marcons. We did be able to show that if Marcons is present, but mitoribosones are normal, you don't need to worry about the Marcons. But if mitoribosones are abnormal, they're the polycyclic ether toxins are made by Marcons. That's been the real bugaboo, is that we were able to show in multiple mass spec studies that these new unknown polycyclic ethers were made by Marcons, but they're not in any library, the fragmentation. Well, you and I were going to run up.
Yeah, right. I know, I wanted to do something with that. Sorry, I wasn't able to come through on that, but because this is huge, because that's always been the issue is, you know, who's Marcons to treat?
If your mitoribosones are fine, you don't have to treat. Take it from me.
What was that again?
If your mitoribosones are normal.
Right there is a good reason to do the genie, because I mean that there's a lot of Marcons, and you know, you just hate to be treating what's not gonna, especially since so many times the Marcons is you know, you treat it and it, you know, it's one of those things that if the immune system isn't able to get rid of it, you know, 6 months later it's back again, it's there. And it's colonizing you, and it could be, and many people, it is just a commensal, obviously.
We had to retreat away from Beg spray because of we switched over to silver methenamine or silver stains, silver mixed up with EDTA. That did fairly well. A witch hazel preparation came out. And guess what? Every attempt to kill and eradicate by killing didn't work. If we suppress biofilm formation, the normal immune responses in nasal mucus, which are fascinating. You know, there's 400 organisms at a given time in each milliliter of mucus that people make. When you blow your nose, it's 400 organisms, 400 million organisms, 400 organisms, excuse me, sitting in your Kleenex. What are they all doing? They're fighting for their own place. You've got fungi, actinomycetes, bacteria, FAB. In every mucous membrane known, you've got FAB. If you find one out of proportion, yeast vaginitis, well, what really is dropping out are actinos regulating more oxella, for a classic example. Dodderline's bacilli is suppressed. So if you go out of the world of Marcons and you've got too much bacteria, you bring that back into play with plain EDTA for 6 months. It's inexpensive, it works. You wait until the normal microbiologic environment reestablishes, but all you do is you put things back into pecking order.
I like that. It's clinically, it's what we've seen also, is that focusing on the biofilms, is getting good results. Yeah, that's, and you know, it's amazing how many people's brains clear just with that.
If you don't have polycyclic ether, you've got a chance to start clearing your brain. Although, as much as other people like to say, spontaneous healing of neuroquant has not occurred yet. We have 5,000 neuroquants in our data set. I haven't seen it yet. You need to use medication, VIP usually, to fix brains.
Yeah, absolutely.
Your symptoms might be reduced. But in terms of mechanism, are we looking at correction of gray matter nuclear atrophy by self-healing? No.
Well, turn off the inflammation. And, you know, I don't want to digress far because we want to talk a little bit more about your work with the water damaged buildings, but just a little bit. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I think I'm going to just wrap up this one because we want to keep it to an hour, and then we're going to come back because I want to talk a little bit about COVID and hypercoagulability. It's just one of my little favorite subjects. Just want to hit that one. Maybe we'll do that just before we end, and you can tell me what your feeling has been, because when I haven't seen a lot of COVID patients just by the nature of I live in a county where they locked down hard and people didn't have to go to work. Those who I see. So, I mean, it's amazing how a socioeconomic disease this has been, you know, on some levels, you know.
Okay, well, when we come back, we'll start with the coagulation percentage and controls, cases, PCS negative and PCS positive, and a p-value.
Very good. Just one second here. So